are sure that the kinds of events that we've seen recently are likely to become much more frequent and much more severe. So clearly the world has to be informed about what's going to happen so that we can adapt to these events. We can perhaps invest in infrastructure, in systems whereby societies and communities can adapt to higher frequencies and higher intensities of these events.
But certainly the intensity of what we've seen in Australia, is that what we could be looking at? And when you say more frequent, how frequent?
That's precisely what we're going to try and come up with to the extent possible based on existing knowledge. We have to understand how frequent, how intense. And it must also be pointed out that there's going to be an enormous variation from one part of the world to the other. There are some locations that are clearly far more vulnerable than others for a variety of reasons, not only the geophysical character of these events, but also because of the lack of capacity on the part of local populations to be able to adapt to them. You know, there are some very poor regions in the world where even a small amount of disturbance can cause very serious repercussions.
And would you say we're ill-prepared at the moment to deal with more natural disasters in the future?
Well, at the moment, we're certainly not well enough prepared. And, you know, some places are a little better off than others. I mean, in the Netherlands, they are strengthening and raising the height of their dikes. I was recently in Guyana, where a large area is below the level of the ocean. And every time you have a bad tidal wave, it just goes over the wall that sort of protects those areas, and it causes enormous damage. So, you know, there are some societies where they just don't have the means and the wherewithal by which they can prepare themselves. So I would say, yes, in general, the world is not at all well prepared for these events, which are becoming far more serious and far more frequent.
Now, in Australia, climate scientists have weighed into the debate about the best mechanism or ways of reducing Australia's emissions, and the current debate is about a carbon tax. Would you agree with some of them who've suggested that a carbon tax or a carbon price is the most effective way of reducing Australia's emissions?
Well, we have said in the fourth assessment report of the IPCC that a price on carbon is by far the most effective means globally to bring about mitigation of emissions of greenhouse gases, because, you know, then you're providing a price signal by which new technologies will be developed, consumer actions would be influenced, and producers would move towards low carbon technologies and processes and products. So I think a carbon price is an important part of actions to mitigate emissions of greenhouse gases.
And have you seen a carbon price work effectively in other nations around the world?
Certainly. In some countries, there's been a major impact. There are countries in Europe where it's clearly had a major influence. And these are some of the things that we're going to assess in the fifth assessment report of the IPCC.
Australia produces about 1.5% of the world's CO2. Should Australia be playing a leading role in this debate, or are we by no means a leader? We're being left behind.
Well, I really wouldn't know what to say about Australia, but all I can say is globally, as a society, we need to do much more, because we've clearly brought out in the AR4, the fourth assessment report, that the least cost path of effective emissions reduction would really require us to see that global emissions peak no later than 2015, and that's just 4 years away. So I think if we have to meet that requirement of a least cost trajectory of emissions stabilization, then we really need to move rapidly, and every country in the world has to do that.
Now, looking at stabilising emissions by 2015, I mean, how happy are you with negotiations so far? Are we on track to meet that date?
What really I think counts is for people to take local action. And I see some very good examples of people who are doing things in different parts of the world. This includes businesses, it includes civil society and local government as well. And I think all of this will aggregate to create the conditions by which perhaps we'd also get a global agreement. But at the moment, I feel we shouldn't be sort of putting all our eggs in the global negotiations basket. I think each one of us has to do what we can.
But when do you think there will be a global agreement, given what's happened in Copenhagen, Cancun? Are we looking at Joburg this year or potentially Rio next year?
Frankly, it's very difficult to make any predictions in that regard, because you remember in the Bali conference of the parties, they had clearly laid down the expectation that by Copenhagen we would have a binding agreement, the Bali roadmap, so to speak. But that didn't happen, so I think it's really very difficult to make predictions about when we might get a global agreement. And that's precisely why I think it's critically important that every country, every society, every locality has to look at this as a global challenge, which all of us have to meet effectively in our own respective spheres.
But as the chief of the UN's science body, when would you be saying enough's enough? We need to set up a global agreement to look at stabilising emissions by 2015. If that's missed, when's the cutoff?
I think what we really need is to create adequate awareness of the reality of climate change and the science behind it. And to that extent, I think the scientific community has its task cut out very clearly. We have to ensure that whatever we produce is not only the best possible science that's available, but also ensure that the message reaches out. And in that respect, I have no hesitation in saying that the IPCC has not done enough in the past. If we spread the message, if we create adequate awareness, and, you know, Einstein was right when he said that problems can't be solved at the level of awareness that first created them. So we have to create much greater awareness for solutions to emerge. And I think the scientific community certainly has a responsibility to work in partnership with other stakeholders in bringing about that level of awareness.
Okay, looking at the IPCC, it's adopted new procedures to address questions of conflict of interest and data analysis.
Right.
Following the controversy in 2009 on the leaked emails, what's the key change and how will these new procedures make the IPCC more accountable to its critics?
Well, we are clearly under much greater scrutiny. We're living in a world where something as important and profound as the work that we're doing will certainly be subjected to much more intense scrutiny. And therefore, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, jointly requested a review of IPCC processes and procedures by the Inter-Academy Council, because we want to strengthen the way we function. We've been uniquely successful in the 20-plus years that we've been in existence, but, you know, we have to meet the challenges of the future, and we're living in a world where information spreads around the globe in a few seconds. And, you know, it's a world where news is spread 24/7. So we need to equip ourselves come out successful with all the scrutiny that's taking place. And I'm very happy to say that in Abu Dhabi last week, all the governments came up with decisions that support what the IPCC is doing and also suggest what we could do better, and we're certainly going to do that in the future.
And there have been calls in the past for a one-term limit for the IPCC chairman's position. This was accepted. Do you support this?
Well, I think the panel has supported it, but they've also said that in exceptional cases, this limit of one term can be relaxed and people can be allowed to run for election for a second or even a third term. So, and all of this will apply only with the next cycle, so it doesn't apply to current office holders.